particular is Ahmed Akhaz Ahmed. Professor Ahmed wears two hats. On the one hand, he's a professor of foreign affairs at Hampton University in Virginia in the States. On the other, he's the executive director of the Iqbal International Institute for Research and Dialogue in Islamabad, Pakistan. And we are lucky that he is here with us today for the following few days. And I have asked him to speak about Islam in Pakistan. As you well know, Pakistan is the only Muslim country in the modern era that had been created in the name of Islam in the wake of the partition in November of 1947 between India and Pakistan. Professor Mumtaz Ahmed.
Chapter. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Thank you very much, Ibrahim. It's my honor and privilege to be here with all of you this afternoon. I know many of you must be very tired and some of you must be very hungry. I will take into consideration when I'll speak. There was question about hell, and that was the last interesting question we were discussing. Discussion on religion ending up in hell is not a good discussion, I would say. I'm least inclined to pass any value judgment on that, since I may have friends in both places, heaven and hell. And somebody said, either it's good, bad. Actually, it depends. One cannot say one is good, one is bad. Somebody said, I think it was Mark Twain who said that depends whether you like a good climate or a good company. One is good for climate, the other is good for company. Anyway, unfortunately, I'm the only one probably among all the speakers who is not a scholar of Islamic studies. I'm a social scientist, student of social sciences. Secondly, unfortunately, I'm the only one who was not born in a city where some Semitic prophet was born, one of our friends. And there is another oddity I noted when I came here and looked around. I'm the only one who is wearing a tie. Isn't it that great? Yeah. And then I thought about it. Since I am coming across the border from the United States of America, your superpower nation, and I don't apologize for wearing a power attire representing the dignity of my country. Yeah. Anyway, a few years ago I was in Bangladesh, and I was conscripted without any notice to be one of the panelists in an interfaith dialogue there. Christians from West Bengal, from the Indian part of Bengal, were invited there from several denominations. Unfortunately, they couldn't find any Jewish in Bengal, in Bangladesh. But there were Buddhists and Muslims and Christians. Before the panel started, I was sitting next to a Christian priest from West Bengal, and we were talking. And then a professor from Dhaka University, a good scholar of Islam, a Muslim, he sat next to us and kind of heard our conversations. And then he asked me, are you a Christian from West Bengal? I said, yes, 25%. Then he was a little shocked. I had to explain when my turn came in my formal presentation. I said, I am, in fact, 25% Jewish, 25% Christian, 45% Muslim, and 5% Hindu, because much of mysticism in subcontinent came from Hindu mysticism. So this is the kind of tradition I come from. And I was not making it up, or I was not exaggerating. Come to think of it, Islam, our Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, never claimed any originality on his part. He never said that he's preaching something new, something unique. He said he's only reminding the people of the message that was revealed to the earlier prophets. Prophet Abraham, Prophet Moses, Prophet Jesus. So whenever some of my Jewish friends and Christian friends, they say, well, this has been borrowed from Judaism, and this has been borrowed from Christianity, this Islamic tradition, that Islamic tradition. It doesn't embarrass me. I feel proud of it, because I have my Jewish heritage, I have my Christian heritage, and that makes me quite proud of it. For both the Jews and the Christians, there is so much familiar in Islam, in its theology, in its doctrines, that they don't seem to be thrilled about Islam, because it's so familiar. It's not as exotic. Islam is not as exotic as Hinduism is, for example, for the Western consciousness, or as Buddhism is. If a Christian asks a Muslim, what do you believe? And the Muslim would say, well, I believe in one God. I believe in life after death. I believe in the fundamental accountability, moral accountability of man. I believe that on the day of judgment, we will be all called upon to account for our deeds in this world. We believe in freedom of will of mankind. And we believe in good deeds. And we also believe that this man and universe was not created without any purpose. And then the Christian would say, well, in that case, I'm a Muslim. There's a very well-regarded Muslim who passed away recently, Khurram Murad. He was based in the United Kingdom, a Pakistani scholar. He was an engineer by profession, but wrote a lot of things about Islam and Islam in the West. He came to the United States about 15 years ago, a couple of years before he died, and he gave a talk in the presence of a large Muslim audience in Indianapolis. And after his talk, he talked about Islam in the West, Muslim community in the West, and somebody asked him, he said, how do we preach Islam to the people here in the United States? How do we convert them? And his answer was very simple. He said, you don't need to convert them. They are already Muslims. You are among the believers. You are among the believers. You don't need to ask the Christians to convert to Islam, because they are Muslim, Muslim in generic sense, which is believers in God. So that's how I look at the entire situation. Now, it's I thought about it, how I will approach my presentation here. And one of the reasons is, if there is so much familiarity, so much affinity, so much brotherhood, and somebody said cousinship between Islam and Christianity, how do we explain the history of hostile relationship? And I think the best explanation came from a Canadian scholar, Wilfred Kenfield Smith, who was probably the finest scholar of Islam, in my view, in the 20th century. Wilfred Kenfield Smith said that there is a historical legacy of hostility between Islam and Christians because cousins are never good friends. Cousins hate each other. So it is this affinity that has kept us apart, paradoxically speaking. Anyway, I'll try to focus my remarks on Islam in South Asia. South Asia basically means Indian subcontinent, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh. Although Islam is very integral to the life of the Muslims in South Asia, but as with other religion, the way Islam is practiced, understood, and experienced in the everyday life of the Muslim communities in South Asia, it is not uniform. It's not homogeneous. There's a great diversity and varieties of ways in which the Muslims in South Asian subcontinent experience Islam in their everyday life. And I would try to identify some most prominent streams or understandings or expressions of Islam in South Asia. I won't call them sects or denominations. I would say different orientations or understandings or different expressions of Islam in South Asia. The first I would identify as what you call the Orthodox Sunni Islam, which is the most dominant form of Islam in the South Asian subcontinent. I wouldn't say mainstream Islam, because I consider Shia Islam as much mainstream as is Sunni Islam, or Ismaili Islam as much mainstream. This is one good thing, is that there is no quote-unquote mainstream as far as I am concerned. But majority of the Muslims in South Asia belong to what you call the Orthodox Sunni form of Islam. And this Islam is represented by the ulama. The roughly speaking equivalent to the clergy in Christianity, although there is no ordained priesthood in Islam, but the ulama are the traditionally trained scholars of Islam who have been trained in the madrasas, in the religious seminaries. And they claim themselves to be the guardians of Islamic tradition. This, their main concern of the ulama, of the Orthodox Islam, is the preservation of the integrity of Islamic tradition, preservation of Islamic education, preservation of the integrity of Islamic family law, personal law, and also the Sharia, the Islamic law. They interpret Islamic law, they guide the Muslim community on the particular understanding and implementation of Islamic law in everyday life. They administer rituals of Islam and guide the Muslim community how to conduct prayer, for example, how to offer pilgrimage to Mecca, and how to operate as a Muslim. The second stream of Islam, which is very popular in South Asia, we got a wonderful, wonderful glimpse of that Islam from our brother Shams Nanji Sahab, the Sufi Islam, the mystical dimension of Islam. And this tradition is popular both among the Sunnis as well as the Shias. Sufi Islam is probably much more integral to the Ismaili tradition than in any other tradition. The devotionalism, the depth of love, the urge to find oneness with God, to seek closeness to God, is very, very strong in some of the poetry that was recited by Shams Saab. Shams, by the way, in Arabic, it means sun. And I hope, I wish I could reflect some of the light that he was able to spread here. Anyway, mainly the concern of the Sufi Islam is with the personal and spiritual enrichment of individuals and purification of individuals. But it's not totally otherworldly. I mean, some of the kind of misconception of Sufism is that it's totally unworldly, totally devoid of any concern with this world, or totally devoid of any concern for the welfare of human beings, as some of the poetry that Shams Saab has recited, you must have realized. It has its feet firmly on the ground, on the earth, but it's trying to rise to heavenly heights. Unlike the institutional and legalistic orientation of the Sunni orthodoxy, Sufi Islam is essentially devotional. It's non-ritualistic, and hence it's more universalistic and more tolerant of other religious traditions than the orthodox Sunni Islam is. The third Islam, again, the third expression of Islam, which already has been explained by the two very learned speakers, is the Shia Islam, which includes both the 12 Shias, which were explained by our brother from Iraq, as well as the Ismaili branch of Shiism, as explained by Shams Sahib. The Shia communities in South Asia constitute between 15 to 20%, sometimes some people say 25%, depending whether the figures are being given by a Shia or by a Sunni. I'm being a Sunni, I would say 12%. Okay. No, I'm sorry. No. Yeah. Probably 20 to 25% are Shias. Very rich presence of Shia in the northern areas of Pakistan, as well as in the central heartland of Pakistan, which is Punjab province, and in Karachi. Bangladesh has a very small population of Shias, but a large number of population in India, particularly in North India. And then, of course, if you go outside the subcontinent, you have the Shia majority country, which is Iran and Iraq, and then you have several other countries which have Shia minority, but nobody talks about them. We are not allowed to. For example, in Bahrain, Shias are in majority. In Kuwait, there's a large number of Shia community. In Saudi Arabia, there's a large number of Shia community. But these are the hidden kind of communities. The local rulers feel very embarrassed in talking about or acknowledging that there are Shias there. Anyway, they are known for their intense love of the household of the Prophet, and particularly the cousin and the son-in-law of the Prophet, Imam Ali, and his son, grandson of the Prophet, Hussein. But it doesn't mean that the love of the household of the Prophet and Ali and Hassan and Hussein is only confined to the Shias. The Sunnis, Muslims also have almost the same intensity of the love for the household of the Prophet and of Imam Ali and Hussein as the Shias have. The Sunnis essentially, basically, somebody suggested, I think it was Sayyid Hussein Nazar, who once said that Sunnis represent the rational mind of Islam and the Shias represent the love and devotion of heart of Islam. So it's a kind of mind, heart and mind kind of thing. I'm not going to suggest that Sunnis are more rational than the Shias, but you find more devotionalism, more kind of personal love and a heartfelt kind of relationship in Shia Islam than in Sunni Islam. Sunni Islam is a little dry, more ritualistic, more legalistic, but this is what it's very interesting. Mr. Shams pointed out that these are the two different what you call the what's the Urdu word for daya, English word for daya, two needs of human existence, heart and mind. And these two expressions of Islam represent the two needs of human soul and human body. The fourth variety or expression of Islam, what I call the modernist and liberal Islam. And this does not have any sectarian orientation. You have modernist and liberal Muslims among the Shias, among the Ismailis, among the Sunni Muslims. And these are the Muslims that represent the efforts on the part of the Western educated Muslims since the late 19th century up to now to reconcile the traditional Islamic teachings with the values, institutions, and ideas of the modern world. I'm not saying modern West. These are not the people who want to westernize Islam, but they want to seek some kind of a reconciliation between Islam and the modern times. From Sir Sayyid Ahmad Khan in the 19th century to Muhammad Iqbal, the poet philosopher of the early 20th century, to Fazlur Rahman, who was my teacher at the University of Chicago, you have so many people in South Asian Islam who represent this tradition of Islamic modernism. And their efforts toward reconciling the two strands, the Western and the Islamic strands, have become considerably popular. The acceptance of the modern education system, the acceptance of the modern banking system, the incorporation in the Muslim consciousness of the institution of parliament, democracy, elections, political parties, and all other things is a package that the Islamic modernists have popularized in Muslim South Asia. Finally, not finally, number five, you have the revivalists and the what you call in the State Department terminology, political Islam, are Islamists. These are the people Islamists are revivalist Islam, or political Islam is essentially represented by a group of Islamic writers, thinkers, who were not traditionally trained religious scholars. They were laymen, and they were exposed both to Western education as well as to the traditional Islamic education. They were not satisfied with the response of the Orthodox ulama to the problems and challenges of modernity. But they were also not satisfied with some kind of apologetic response given by the Islamic modernists. So the revivalists and the political Islamists kind of arose in between the two extremes, the Orthodox, traditionalists, conservatives on the one hand, and the Islamic liberals and modernists on the other. The revivalists' position was that the solution to the challenges faced by the Muslim community in the 20th century is not to give in to the West and to accept the West, what they call the lock, stock and barrel, but to accept the Western notions, institutions, with some critical approach, and take modernity not as an ideal, but sort of select some good thing from the West, but essentially we should go back to the fundamental texts of Islam, which is the Quran and the tradition of Prophet Muhammad. The second most important element in their ideology was that Islam is a complete way of life. Now, it's a truism, and it sounds like a cliche. Islam is a complete way of life. It covers all aspects of human life, whether it's your personal life, your life as a husband, as a person in charge of family, whether as a teacher, as a businessman, as an executive, as a politician, social, economic, political, international relations. It covers everything. Now, if you say this thing, that Islam is a complete way of life in this sense, then you have to take the next step, which is in order to implement Islam in all walks of life, you have to have the power of the state. Because you cannot have Islam in social and economic and political and legal and constitutional and educational and commercial spheres if you don't have the power of the state. That gives legitimacy to the Islamists' struggle for the participation in the political process. And they say that their participation in the political process is not to capture political power for the sake of power, but to capture the power of the state in order to implement God's law, God's Sharia. That's what simply political Islam is. And even in political Islam, it's not one single animal. You have different varieties and different orientations. You have extremists who want to establish this Islamic state through revolutionary methods, through violence, through upheavals, through coups. And then you have moderate Islamists who want to transform their societies and establish an Islamic system of government through participation in democratic electoral process without using any violence. When I was listening to my colleagues, I was jotting down a few points which I recited. Ibrahim did not tell me what was supposed to be my topic, so I just sat down and wrote a few things here. Anyway, I have been blaming Ibrahim for my own lack of preparation since yesterday, and I'll continue to blame him until Monday. Then it occurred to me that I'm leaving another variety or expression of Islam. And probably it would be very dishonest on my part not to talk about it, which is radical Islam, extremist Islam, militant Islam, jihadi Islam. This is a totally new variety. I'm not going to go into the detail of its origin, but I'll just give you the date. It originates with the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in 1979, with the rise of the Mujahideen movement in Afghanistan. Who supported the Afghan Mujahideen movement? Who were the actors who became very prominent in encouraging the rise of this militancy and radicalism and jihad? We all know them. But the fact of the matter is that since the early 1980s, this variety, this expression of Islam, although it's still a very, very small minority within Pakistan that is engaged in this kind of radicalism, but unfortunately, this is a small minority that hits the international headlines. And it is about this Islam that people in the West are more familiar. We know more about Osama bin Laden than we know about Dr. Muhammad Yunus, who was awarded the Nobel Prize for helping the poor people. We know more about Osama bin Laden than about Ehtezaz Ehsan, a Pakistani lawyer who struggled for the freedom of judiciary in Pakistan and has sacrificed his entire career for this purpose. And we do not know about hundreds and thousands of other quietly working Muslims, men and women, who are working for the welfare of their community, welfare of the humanity. Nobody knows about them. We do not know anything about Abdul Sattar Eidi, who runs the largest charitable organization in South Asia, who has only two sets of dress. One he is wearing, and the other he has ready is being washed. He only wears one plastic sandals. He has only two sets of dress. The man is operating a charity which is about $600-700 million worth it. And he is helping Muslims, non-Muslims, everywhere. So this is another Islam, what we call a more kinder, gentler Islam, about which we know very little about it. We always talk about Osama bin Laden and other things. I think I should stop here, and since I said I must take into consideration that we have been here for quite some time. Thank you very much.
You're engaging in it.
Sure. Very happy.
Thank you so much. Those of you who'd like to enter into this, please.
Could you explain the concept of Sharia law, how that fits into these various mainstream groups of Islam that we refer to and into the Islamic State, and how it fits into the Islamic community in North America, I guess?
Sharia is a very broad term. It has been translated into English as Islamic law. But Sharia, as a very comprehensive concept, incorporates so many things. How do you purify yourself with water when you are going to perform your prayer? That's also a part of the Sharia. How do you start your fasting? How do you break your fast? That's also a Sharia, right? The laws that govern marriage, divorce, inheritance, custody of children, they are also Sharia. There are certain laws about civil matters, commercial matters, how to transact business with the rest of the laws about the marketplace, transactions, buying and selling, the laws about the penal laws, for example. This all of this is Sharia. Sharia is a moral code. It's an ethical code also. And Sharia, devoid of the ethical teachings of Islam, is only a bare bones. It's a kind of linguistic hair splitting. The other important thing about Sharia is most of the scholars, when you talk to them, they make a distinction between two things. One they call Maqasad Sharia, and then they call the actual nitty-gritty of Sharia. Maqasad Sharia, objectives of Sharia, goals of Sharia. And the understanding of the overwhelming majority of the Muslims today is that what is most important is not the nitty-gritty of Sharia, but the objectives of Sharia. For example, if Sharia says that you need to wash your hands 3 times, right? Is it absolutely important that I have to wash my hand 3 times? If the objective only is you clean up your hand. If I can buy, what is the thing that they are selling in stores? You just sort of pump it and it cleans up some kind of anti-germ kind of thing. Purex kind of thing. Okay, so if I don't have a water, can I use Purex to wash my hand? No. A ritualistic, legalistic, literalist jurist would say, no. You have to have water. Because the Sharia law says you have to have. But a more wiser person would say the objective of Sharia is to insist that you wash your hands. And if the water is not available, you can wash. So you see that what I'm talking about. It's a very small example. But if you extrapolate this example to the larger issues, for example, the fundamental objective in politics that people derive from Quran and from the tradition of the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam is that the Muslims are those whose public affairs are decided by shura, which means consultation. Now, the objective of the Sharia is that public affairs of the Muslim community must be decided not by one person, but by the collective consultation of the community. Question: is Parliament of today can be an institutional expression of consultation? Many people say yes. So the understanding of Sharia and its practical implementation in today's world will be guided by the objectives of Sharia, not by the literal injunctions of Sharia.
Last night you said, you made a comment about people being asked if they believe in Sharia and then being asked if they like that cut off hands.
Yeah.
Just a moment on that.
Exactly. There was one poll by Gallup International, the Pakistani branch of the Gallup. And then there was another polling that we did also at the Iqbal International Institute. And the question was, since everyone said, we want Sharia. And one of the questions was, do you support the introduction of Sharia in Pakistan? A very bland question. Almost 90% in one case, which is the rule, and 70 to 75% in the urban areas, they said, yes, we want Sharia. Then, after a few other questions, we asked them, do you approve of the Islamic penal law of Sharia that requires the chopping of hands of the thieves? The same percentage of people, 90-75, said no. Then we picked up about five other specific injunctions of Sharia and asked the people, do you want the government to introduce this? They said no. How do you reconcile people's response, 90% people saying we want Sharia, and then you specify and tell them, do you want this? And they said no, we don't want this. Our only explanation was that in the popular perception of the majority of people, and here I'm not only talking about Pakistan, in Egypt, in Jordan, in Tunisia, in the popular perception of ordinary Muslims, Sharia stands for justice.
Great.
For a system that is not corrupt, that is accountable, and that can provide to them quick, inexpensive, and real justice.
Yes.
I'm a graduate student at the University of Alberta here. I study political theory of dialogue between Islam and the West, and of course that's an oversimplification because, as you said, there's more than one Islam and more than one West.
Can you all hear?
Okay. There's a campaign on campus going on by one of my colleagues to boycott, divest, and sanction the State of Israel and Toto, including the intellectual production by those Israelis, whether Jews, Christians, or Muslims, who are speaking out against the State of Israel. So I'm trying to forge a campaign in order to bring people on campus together to talk about peace as a primary motive instead of being partial in protest. I'm not going to go on about it, but I was wondering what your personal opinion is on that and how I would be able to, as the initiator of this campaign, move beyond the rhetoric of us versus them when I sit down with the Palestinian Solidarity Network to try to say to them that this is not the proper avenue for dialogue. Thank you.
Well, the Arab-Israeli question and the Palestinian question is one of the toughest questions in international affairs. I would defer to Dr. Ibrahim Abu Rabia. He's an expert. He's a Palestinian. He has studied the question in much more depth than anyone else probably here. So probably he would be the best person to answer that. My part of the what's called the two penny answer is the following. The boycott has been a tactics that has been used very successfully against the apartheid system in South Africa, for example. Investment boycott of the products produced by South Africa during apartheid time, that hurt very much the apartheid regime, and I believe it hastened the process of the transformation of the system there. The boycotting of the products of Israel, is it going to hurt only the Israelis, or is it going to hurt also the products that are produced and manufactured by the Palestinians as well? That's one question. The second thing is, particularly those Israeli intellectuals who have been intimately involved in the justification of the destruction of Palestinian communities in Gaza and in the West Bank, I will have absolutely no reluctance and hesitancy in boycotting them, not inviting them to the universities in the United States, in England, anywhere in Canada, because I would consider them as morally responsible for what their government is doing in Gaza and in the West Bank. But Israel, like any other society, is a very diverse society. It's in Israel you have a peace movement. And there are many Jewish groups that are fighting for the rights of the Palestinians as intensely as the Palestinians are. So we have to make a distinction. Thank you.
Raymond, I'll come to you in a minute.
I think you've answered my question. Would I be right to conclude that there's nothing essential in Islam, in the sources, that precludes or militates against the formation of secular democratic forms of government with the guarantees of the freedoms that we value?
Everybody hear this? That there's nothing in the sources of Islam that precludes the forming of liberal, secular, democratic societies.
It's true with one small qualification. Not small qualification, but according to it's very important, which is that if secularism is defined in an American sense, probably, or in the British sense, where you have some kind of symbolically Queen being the head of the Church of England, but there's a freedom of religion for all religious communities. But secularism in the sense in which in the general perception of the South Asian Muslim, I think some linguistic trick took place, and because of that there's a secularism is seen in a very pejorative manner. It was translated into Urdu as La Diniyat, which means irreligiosity. And that's why whenever the word secularism is used, people become very nervous, believing that a secular state is the one in which religion is positively opposed. Not that the state is neutral to religion, but state is opposed to religion. This is one problem. The other thing is democracy can take roots and has taken roots in Muslim societies, but there is one philosophical understanding that the Muslims will continue to, which is that democracy will have to operate within the broader framework of Islam. In other words, in Islamic society, there will always be some limits on the legislation, popular legislation. For example, it is inconceivable that in a Muslim society you can pass a law legalizing gay marriage. Right? So within, you will have to work within the broader framework of Sharia. This is my understanding. That will be the limits on. But these are the limits where in most of the democratic societies have. In the United States, for example, there are certain defined limits beside which you cannot conceive that laws will be passed or something.
Is that satisfactory? Right?
Yes, I was thinking of the secular as a society where no member of any religious group has a citizenship that gives them advantages or rights that
yes.
a member of another religious group
yes.
doesn't
have. No yeah. state-sponsored religion.
Yeah, yeah. I think, even you see, in the traditional understanding, there was a distinction made by some of the scholars that in an Islamic state, you have two categories of people. One are the Muslims, who are the full citizens, and then you have the Dhimmis, the protected people of the book, who will be protected by the Islamic state. They will have some exemptions and all these things. But I think this understanding is no longer relevant. You have many Muslim societies where Muslims and non-Muslims have equal rights, political rights, and religious rights and religious freedoms. Of course, then you have examples in some of the countries, and Pakistan, unfortunately, is one of them, where the some religious minorities are persecuted. And then there are some other countries, Muslim countries also, where non-Muslims do not exercise equal rights with the Muslims. But these are the rulers who are equal opportunity oppressors. They oppress their Muslim population, and they oppress their non-Muslim population. And I'm not very proud of what sometimes happens to the Christian community in Pakistan, where they are singled out for persecution, and it appears that not always for religious reasons. Recently, when I was in Islamabad in December, there was a case in which one Christian school teacher in the province of Punjab, he was accused by a couple of his colleagues that he said some nasty words insulting the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. And so the entire community protested against him, and there were rallies against him. And the poor guy had to be put in jail only for his protection. Later on, it was discovered that this guy had said nothing insulting the Prophet Muhammad. The other teacher wanted his job.
It's an old story.
And but let me conclude. The last category I should have mentioned, which I thought I would end up with what kind of eclectic Islam that is very much there in South Asia. And the one thing that occurred to me when I was listening here was how kind of different streams of Islam, they merged together. The orthodoxy of Sunni Islam and the devotionalism of Shia Islam and the spirituality of Sufi Islam and some of the elements of modern Islam and revivalist Islam, they merged together. And not only that, but the legacy of the British colonial rule is part of that South Asian Islamic tradition. And I recently read memoirs by one of the generals in the Pakistan Army who was very close to President General Zia-ul-Haq. General Zia-ul-Haq was the one who ruled Pakistan from 1977 to 1988. And the story goes that a group of Muslim pilgrims during the Hajj season, they were going to for Hajj. And at that time, many of the people, I'm talking about the mid-1980s, they would go by ships. Now, of course, everybody flies to Jeddah. And so the tradition is that when the first ship of the Hajis, of the pilgrims, leave for Mecca, the head of the state goes to see them off. It's a kind of become a ritual, like the U.S. president throwing the first ball kind of thing.
Very similar.
Very similar, yeah. So President Zia-ul Haq, with all his religious garb and all these things, his kind of religious posture, he shows up at the Karachi dockyard, naval dockyard, and the ship is ready. About 1,000 Hajis are packed there, and the Hajis are sort of marching towards the ship. And the Pakistan Navy has been asked to bring their band in order to play something. And when Zia-ul Haq is saying goodbye, and may Allah bless your efforts and accept your Hajj, and the commander of the Navy, he signals to his band to start playing band. And the naval band starts playing, what's the tune? Onward, Christian Soldier.
Thank you so much.
That was the only tune they knew.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.